these next few days. Chazara is always valuable just for itself, but there is an added component to Chazara, especially when you're dealing with complicated sugyas, that the more you've seen, so the more you understand from what you're seeing. So it's not just a matter of hearing the same discussions again, but it's now with the knowledge of all the other sugyas or parts of the broad sugya that we talked about. So hopefully as we go over some concepts now, they will be more meaningful than they were the first time around. And you will relate to them on a deeper level than you will the first time around. And that's part of the beauty of the Chazara experience. And particularly in a sugya like Bav Metzia, the first part of Bav Metzia, where so many different things interlock with each other. So to try to dig down some of the introductory points that we made. First of all, we took note of the fact that there is a particular privilege in learning Mishpatim, so to speak, in learning Nezikin. It's not something to be underappreciated. That even though we believe there's a tremendous value to Talmud Torah as a whole, so there is a unique value to principles that we're able to relate to intellectually. That if we're able to have some kind of an understanding about what's going on, that gives us an even greater pesach to understand the Chachmas HaTorah. And we mentioned in this context, a little bit by way of introduction, that the Chafetz Chaim was once approached by someone who wanted to buy all of his Sfarim, with the notable exception of Chafetz Chaim. And he asked, how come you don't want Chafetz Chaim? And the person said, he's a businessman, he's out there in a very nasty, competitive environment, and he doesn't think he'll be able to keep those halachas. Mishneh Berurah, Likutei Halachos, all the other Sfarim, Chafetz Chaim, will not be a problem for him, but be careful how you speak about people, he doesn't think he's going to be able to do that. The Chafetz Chaim quoted from Yisrael Salanter, who said that this Sefer, Chafetz Chaim, is worthwhile even if all you accomplish with it is that one Jew reads this Sefer and you would think the next line is changes his behavior. But in fact, the next line was if all he does is sigh. Meaning that he reads this and he says, if only I could live up to the halachas. Oh well, moving on. That would be enough. And we commented that that's not so obvious, because we normally have a rule, mutav shiushogi and realim mezidin, that it's, if you know that a person is not going to observe a certain halacha, a set of halachas, better they shouldn't be told in the first place. So why is it taken as a given here, in the context of Hilchos Lashon Hara, that you're better off knowing about things that you're not committed to keeping, or that you're saying you're not going to be able to keep? So we suggested that it may correlate to what the Rambam writes in Shmona Prakim, that there is a distinction between the mitzvos ben adam lechavero that we can relate to, we call, let's say, the mitzvos sichlios, and the mitzvos that are more chukim oriented, that are less accessible to our rational mind. That the Rambam writes that there is a medrash, a yalkut shimoni, that says that a person should not claim that he is repulsed by Trafus. He sees the signs for McDonald's, two burgers, fries, and a Coke, and a free helicopter for 45 cents. So he's not mechuyev to say that's not attractive at all. There's nothing wrong with him saying that's a very attractive offer. But what can I do? Gzeiras HaMelech, God told me I can't. So says the Rambam, that's only true for chukim. But when it comes to the mitzvos that we can relate to somewhat, and we can understand them intellectually on some level, so then you could imagine if a person were to walk around saying all day, oh, I wish I could just kill people all the time. But what can I do? Xeris HaMelech, Torah says I can. So as we noted, that person is going to have a very hard time getting a roommate. And that's clearly not the Ben Torah that we strive to create. So the Rambam essentially maintains that yes, it's one category of chukim where we don't where we don't fully relate to what's going on. And there we say, all right, there's no mitzvah to pretend that you're repulsed, that you're horrified by treifus. But when it comes to the mitzvahs that we can relate to somewhat, so then the Torah does want us to mold our personality in sync with that idea. And that perhaps this is what Rabbi Yisrael was saying, that when it comes to Hilchos Lashon Hara, so even if a person doesn't actually follow the rules, but he learns about them, since they are principles that he can access mentally, intellectually, so we can still hope it will have an impact on his personality. And that's perhaps also why the Netziv writes in his commentary to Chumash that the concept of Bal Tosif doesn't apply with the mitzvot sichlios, with the more mishpatim-related mitzvot. And therefore, in addition to what we usually have when it comes to the milas of Talmud Torah, so we learn Bav Metzia, we have an extra level of milas. There is something here that's not always present in other types of limudim. And this is especially true in Bav Metzia, in our Mishnah, our opening sugya, where we talk about different ways of dividing up property or of addressing property that's in dispute. So we took note of the fact that these different methods that we'll talk about, for the most part, there's no mucker given for any of these. They're not based on psukim. They're not based on drashos. Seems that this is essentially Chazal telling us what makes sense in terms of addressing these types of conflicts, and therefore trying to get into the depths of how they came to these conclusions is a particularly rewarding experience. The only thing that comes close among these methods to having any mucker is Hamotzi Mechaver Olavaraya. That's a machlokus in the Gemara to what extent that's derived from a pasuk or not. But other than that, all the different methodologies we'll talk about, such as Yachloku and our Mishnah, are not derived from any clear pasuk as far as we know. And therefore, it's essentially Chazal telling us on a level of Minat Torah what makes sense in terms of addressing these conflicts. So being able to study that kind of material and to really try to understand the Seichel of Chazal in addressing these issues is really a fascinating opportunity. And we also noted that this may have also an impact on how you would think that non-Jews should address these situations, because non-Jews are also obligated to adjudicate their disputes, min ha-Torah. The mitzvah of din is the one positive mitzvah among the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach. So therefore, even non-Jewish society also has such an obligation. And there was a machlokus between the Rambam and the Ramban as to what that mitzvah is about. The Ramban says that it means that all of the principles of Choshen Mishpat apply universally, apply to non-Jews as well. That's a big chiddush. The Rambam understands the mitzvah of din as being more about enforcing the six prohibitions. But even without coming on to the Ramban, there has to be some way of deciding how you're going to regulate things. So if this is all svara, so then presumably it makes sense in that context as well. So then we got into a little bit of a discussion about what is the purpose of Beis Din, what is Beis Din looking to accomplish, and how is that possibly background for our Masechta and for our Sugya. We discussed the fact that there is a concept of Din and a concept of Pshara, that the Pasuk says in Parshas Shoftim, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof, and the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Echad l'din v'echad l'pshara, that one of these words, tzedek, is meant to convey the letter of the law, and the other is meant to convey pshara. We noted that pshara is often translated as compromise, but it's probably not an adequate translation, but it'll work for now. And therefore the question can be raised, what is Beis Din's key function? Is Beis Din looking to make peace in the world? Or is Beis Din looking to reach the emes lamito as much as possible? And that's very possibly the background for some of these issues. We mentioned how David Miller had discussed this in his shiurim and pointed out that this seems to be a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban and Parshas Shoftim. that in Parsha Shoftim, the Ramban on Tzedek Tirdof emphasizes Plilim, emphasizes the idea that judges are supposed to resolve disputes, while the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos, when he talks about the Tafkid of the Sanhedrin, emphasizes the role of ordering society, being good for the community as a whole, and possibly that reflects some of these differences. So within that context, we talked a little bit about what Pshara means and about the role of Beis Din in addressing Pshara. We mentioned that Tosfos in Sanhedrin says that Pshara is different than Din, because Din, we follow Rov. If two Dayanim say one thing and one Dayan says something else, we follow the majority. And in Pshara, Tosfos suggests we require unanimous vote. And the question of why that is, Rav Soloveitchik and his Shiurim discussed a couple of possibilities. A lot of possibilities that he didn't like. That maybe it's because Pshara is not actually imposed like Din is imposed, and therefore we need a unanimous panel if we're going to tell the parties to accept it. Didn't really like that pshat. Another pshat was that... I wonder if we should close the windows. If we'll be too hot. We'll play with it. So another possibility is that since it doesn't involve actually figuring out something, we're not trying to be mavara the din, we're essentially creating a new type of assessment of the situation, so perhaps that requires a unanimous assessment. And that the Rav understood the role of Pshara is that it's a psak of Lufnim Meshur Sadin, which is the concept we've discussed in greater detail, Lufnim Meshur Sadin, in our second parak, Sunday Bekiah Shirim, talking about Yasiso Yashav Atov in that context. And therefore, one shouldn't see Pshara as simply a compromise. We mentioned before it's perhaps an inadequate translation. It's not about simply splitting the difference, but it's about Beis Din assessing what is the most just resolution to this issue. So that's also derived from the word tzedek, echel adin v'echel apshara. These are two different ways, one more based on the letter of the law and one that takes into consideration factors of lufnim meshuras adin in terms of how we assess things. So we have to figure out to what extent is Beis Din driven by a need to make justice to the letter of the law, emes lamito, or also a spirit of pshara, should that be the dominant aspect that Beis Din is focusing on. And we spoke also about the role of umdana in this issue, how the Rabbaz has a tshuva, and to what extent does Beis Din make decisions based on what seems true to them, or are they required to work off certain basic thresholds of evidence. So we mentioned the Rabbaz's tshuva, for example, talking about the context of Shlomo HaMelech's din, be the Haftorah for Parshas Miketz. Shlomo HaMelech, when he had his famous story with the baby, and he said Yachloku, different kind of Yachloku, that the baby should be split. And then one mother said, no, that's terrible, don't do that. And the other mother said, that sounds like a great idea. So he gave it to the mother who said, don't do that. So what's pshat on that story? Is it pshat that he paskined based on that? That this was an umdana, that it made sense, that the one who's the real mother wouldn't want her kid to be cut up? Or should we say, no, he's not really justified in paskining based on umdanas. He'd have to paskin based on something else. The question whether there's a muchzak here, that was also a part of his discussion. So should we say that really he can't paskin based on his assessment of the facts? He has to have a more formalized threshold of how to paskin. And the whole point of the story of the drama and splitting up the baby was about making the ruling be accepted. This was his way of getting them to realize that he figured out who it is, but it wasn't necessarily the way in which he made the decision. So there's a lot of literature about that, which also goes to this question of what is the role of Beis Din. So, coming off of that introduction, so we see that our Mishnah tells us one of the ways in which we figure out how to address things if you have two parties fighting over some common property. And we saw that there are essentially probably 5 or 6 different possibilities of how to do it. There is our Mishnah, which is Yachloku with a Shvua. There's also an option of Yachloku without a Shvua, which you could consider different or a subcategory. The first other possibility that's brought as a contrast is the topic of the Gemara in the third parak of Bava Basra, called Olam Gvar, which we'll get into in more detail, but seems to mean might makes right, that we let them fight it out. Either they fight it out with rayas, or they fight it out with actual strength, but we let them go at it, essentially. Then there is a category called Shuda Dedaini, that we allow the Dayanim to assess who they think should get it. And we'll see it's machlokas, whether they have any obligation to be somewhat objective in how they do it. And there's a concept called Yehei Munach, that sometimes we say that because of the dispute, that the item in question has to stay in escrow, so to speak, until Eliyahu can come and decide who's right. And then there is also the default position of Hamotzei Mechavero Olav Arayim. So Rishonim have different ways of assessing when you do one, when you do the other. The Rabbahs we mentioned in Achuva lays out different principles for all of the 6. The Ramban, his comments to Bava Basra, he has his decision as to how you decide which of the 6 to take. And the first topic that we took up is our Mishnah. So our Mishnah talks about Yachloku. And the Rishonim will ask, so what about Kol Da'alim Gvar? That scenario that comes up in the Gemara in Bava Basra, that if you have 2 people fighting over a boat, let's say, there's a certain boat that's out there on the dock, and 2 people both claim that it's theirs. So the Gemara has this ruling of Kol Da'alim Gvar. So the Rishonim take up the issue of how do you decide when to do Yachloku, and when do you do Kol Da'alim Gvar. So a number of svaras are brought forth as being relevant to the distinction. What was considered to be relevant? Ochsin, did someone say ochsin? Whether there is any kind of achiza on the 2 parties. What else is relevant? Vaday Ramai, that maybe if we have a situation where we know one party is lying, that will force us to act a certain way. What else could be relevant? Right, if it's a situation where you may be able to figure out more about what the circumstances are, that might itself be relevant. What else? Jarer's Ramona, that mysterious term which we discussed separately, so we'll come back to it later. But this mysterious X factor, which is subject to a whole range of interpretations, that may also play a role in which path you take. All of those are brought forward by Rishonim in terms of trying to set rules, trying to decide how you pick among these various systems, and particularly between these 2, between Yachloku and Kol Da'alim Gvar, all of those make an appearance. And one of the major approaches, and many of the Rishonim maintain, that Ochsim is the significant factor. And that's on our Daf, on Daf Beis Amud Aleph, so Tosfos is Rabbeinu Tam, that Ochsim is the key reason why you will distinguish. This is the second Tosfos on the page. Yishlomar the Ochsin Shiny. And Tosfos and Bava Basra quotes Rabbeinu Tam as saying that, but quotes the Riva, another Rishonim have the Ritzbah and the Riva, all of the Rishonim whose names begin with Reish Yud, they all have the approach that you don't need Ochsin specifically, but that it's a question of whether or not there's a Ramai. So here you have a lot of Rishonim saying Ochsin is the key factor, Tosfos primarily, and in Bava Basra it's 2 days in Tosfos with the Riva saying you don't need Ochsin, you just need no Ramai. And then the Riva goes on to say something fascinating, which we'll discuss separately, that however, as much as I say the Riva that you don't need Ochsin, but if you do have Ochsin, so then you can still have Yachloku even if it's Be'ikar Ramai. Which points in a couple directions, as we'll discuss when we get up to it. So that idea that Ofzen is the key issue that our Tosfos and Rabbeinu Tam maintain. So an interesting point that we ended up discussing more recently. So until recently, we thought that Rashi was probably in that camp also. Because the first Rashi in the Masechta said, Davka Ochzin, the Shnehem Uchzakin Ba. And that's specifically a circumstance where you have Ochzin, that's where you have Yachloku. But otherwise, you wouldn't. So it sounds like Rashi is with Rabbeinu Tam. But we mentioned recently in the context of Migo that the Netziv had a fascinating diak where he says just the opposite. And he thinks that Rashi really goes with the Riva. That really we don't care about Ochsin. All we care about is that neither side has an edge over the other. That both have established themselves to be the two equal players in the story. And the Netziv says that because the rest of Rashi, that after saying Ochsin, he could have just stopped there. But he emphasizes Ve'ein lazeh koach ba yoser mizeh. Sheilu haisa biyad echa levado havi idach hamotzi mechaveru olav aviraya ve'edim shishalo. So the emphasis of Rashi, that goes on to say, is not so much that they're both holding, but that it's not only one who's holding. Or that there isn't any advantage to one side over the other. It was a fascinating diyuk. So because of that diyuk, the Netziv said he thinks Rashi is really in the Rivaz camp, that you don't need Ochsin. That all you need is having the two parties establish some equal connection. And therefore, the Riva has been associated with the Rambam. Because the Rambam, when he talks about the Din of Yachloku, so he lists the scenarios that we're familiar with, but he also adds another case, which was very discussed, which attracted a lot of attention. What's the Rambam's additional case? That seems to... Sorry? Right, it's in a Sitma, but the Arima, right? The situation where you have a pile, the two parties are on either side of a pile of Chitim, so that even though they're not holding it, but they've established themselves as the two relevant parties here, so Yachloku there as well. So the Rambam seems to be in the Rivam Ritzba camp, that you don't need actual Ochsin, and then Siv is understanding that Rashi is really in that camp as well. So there is a lot to say about the whole question of this Machlokus between Rabbeinu Tam and the Ri. And the Re, etc., the Rebam, Reba, all those Re's. But one of the suggestions that we made, again, this was a point that Rav Miller had pointed out, fascinating suggestion, that maybe this emerges from what we were talking about in our introductory comments. The question of what does Beis Din prefer to do? What would Beis Din rather do if they had the choice? Would they rather get the accurate assessment of the truth? The din emes lamito, or would they rather make people happy and make up shara? So he suggested that that's behind Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva, because part of their issue is what is our default position? What would we rather do? Yachlofer or kol da'al mikvar? So the focus that says that we are only concerned about the Ramai, the Riva, that's essentially saying we'd rather do Yachloku. But we don't want to do Yachloku if it's going to mean we're going to reward a Ramai. While Rabbeinu Tam is basically saying we'd rather do Kol Da'alim Gvar. But we don't want to do Kol Da'alim Gvar if it's going to impinge on someone's Chazakah. So since they both have somewhat of a claim, Kol Da'alim Gvar means one person is going to take away from the other guy, that's going to essentially violate this person's chazaka, so we can't do it. That seems to be the premise of the two positions. That Rabbeinu Tam's focus on Ochsin is saying, we'd love to do Kol Da'alim Gvar, but we can't because of Ochsin. And the Riva's position is, we'd love to do Yachloku, but we can't because of Raman. So essentially the question then becomes, what is our preference? Is our preference to do that which is accurate, that which is emes lamito? And as we'll get into, there are those who understand kol da'alim gvar as actually being a way of ascertaining the emes, particularly the Rush, as we'll see. Or would we rather make up Pshara, so to speak? We'd rather split between the two and just, we're limited, we can't do that if it's going to reward a Ramai, but otherwise we'd prefer to do that. So that could revolve around this question, again, of what is the purpose of Bezdin? What is Bezdin angling to do? Would we prefer to make up Pshara, or would we prefer to bring actual truth into the situation?
Right.
So then we'll have to move from that point. So first, it seems like Yechloku is a type of pshara. It involves splitting the difference. So right on the surface, that sounds pshara-like. And then we'll have to define separately, is that really what we mean? Is it actually a pshara, or is it a reflection of a genuine din? Or are there two types? So we'll get into that in a little bit more detail. Hi.
Can you argue the swear backwards that according to the Riva, since he doesn't want a Ramai to ever win, so that's more interested in Din and Emes? According to take, you don't want to take away someone's Chazaka when the Chazaka might not mean anything because you grabbed on later, that could be more of a Shalom issue.
So I think it's a little harder to say that. There is room to look at it different ways. The reason I think it's a little bit less likely to say it like that is because the Ramai is a unique consideration. That if you remove the Ramai issue, so it doesn't mean that this is any more likely to get to the Emes Lamito, normally Achloku. Maybe Yecholo Lios Emes, but no one thinks it's likely Lios Emes. So it's unlikely that the Yachloku really gets us to a true answer. So if we invoke Ramai, we're not saying that we only want to stay away from Yachloku if it's not 100% true. It's only when it's going to reward a liar. And we have to get to that a little bit more about the overlap between Yecholios, Emes, and Ramai. Are the same idea, they're different ideas, but that's, it seems to be that Ramai is a more specific consideration, that we don't want to be the ones rewarding the Ramai. So this could tie into these broader issues about what Bezdin does. And Aaron's point is well taken, that we'll have to figure out, are we really accurate right now in looking at Yachloku as a Pshara? We'll see there's a lot more to the equation. But this is also relevant to a question of Bezdin's role. So we mentioned the first time that Pshara exists as an option. The Gemara actually had a machlokus about this, which is probably also the same issue, that according to one opinion, also livtsoa. It's wrong to tsoa, bitsua is a word that the Gemara uses in Sanhedrin for Pshara, so that it's going to come up in Parsha, maybe a little bit soon, we'll see if we'll get a chance to talk about it. But one opinion in the Gemara says that it's wrong, Livtso, it's wrong to make up Shara. That basically it's an abdication of truth. That if Bezdin is charged with trying to figure out what the truth is, and the Gemara says that being involved in Din is a holy pursuit. The Gemara says that when three are involved in Din, the Shekhinah is present. So maybe you have an obligation to actually carry it through and to suggest getting out of it with a pshara. Maybe that's wrong. That's an opinion in the Gemara, also Lutzoa. So we don't paskin like that. We paskin that mitzvah Lutzoa, it's a good idea. But we generally mean by that that it's recommended to the Bali Din. That the Bali Din are told that if they want, then it's a good idea to try to save themselves the agmas nefesh of the machlokas of going into all the nitty gritty and to opt for a pshara. But the way it sounds like from the Gemara is that Bezdin is never going to impose a pshara. That as long as the parties are interested in din, so then that becomes the Bezdin's obligation. Contemporary Bate Din sometimes choose not to be involved in that role bichlal, and they sometimes only deal in pshara, but then they're still not imposing it on the parties because the parties don't have to use that bezin. But the assumption is that bezin is generally not going to impose a pshara on the parties. And that's the way the Meshech Chachma writes when he comments on that pasuk of Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof. So he says that, yes, there is an idea, Tirdof Achar Pshara also. That means we're addressing the Bali Din when we say that. The litigants should know that it's a good idea to chase after such a type of resolution. But Bezdin is not going to impose it. and the Netziv. The Netziv is both in his comments to Chumash and Hamek Davar, and also in his Chuvis and Meshuv Davar, he says the same thing. But he thinks there is a scenario in which Beis Din will impose Upshar. That if we're up against the wall and you can't find the truth, there isn't going to be any potential of actually resolving this from a truth perspective. So it's going to go on forever unless you make a pshara. So then the Netziv maintained that pshara is a chiyuv on Beis Din. Beis Din will impose a pshara. So that could possibly give us some interesting background to Yachloku, again, if we want to see it as a pshara kind of thing. Because there was one view in the Rishonim, the Rashba, who suggested as the distinction, as Eli mentioned, Ikol Mekim Ola Demilsa. That's a distinction that the Gemara has in Bava Basra, talking about Kol Dal Mivar and the Shuda and other things, that there are differences sometimes if you have a circumstance where it's possible for the facts to come out. So that's Ikol Mekim Ola Demilsa. While you have a scenario that's Lekol Mekim Ola Demilsa, it essentially means that we don't expect Al Pi Derech HaTeva to have any more access to information here. And that there isn't any reason to believe that we're going to know any more than we already know. So then we have to deal with things as is. So the Rashba, one of his possible resolutions to when you say Yachloku and when you say other things, so the Rashba suggests that maybe we say Yachloku if it's a situation of Lech Olamekim Ala Demilsa. So that could theoretically be put together with what the Netziv says. If the Netziv says that in a circumstance where you can't get to the truth, we're going to force a pshara, so maybe Yachloku is in sync with that, and maybe Yachloku is a kind of pshara. And therefore, we will take it as best policy to Lech Olamekim Ala Demilsa in a circumstance where there isn't any hope that we're going to get to any more truth here, where there isn't any more hope for accuracy. So that comment of the Netziv isn't necessarily taking a stand on what's our preferred default position, din or pshara, because he's saying that in a circumstance where din is impossible, then pshara becomes a chiyuv. It's still feasible to say within that that din is still the ideal. So that seems to be a broader background question here. And here we can also invoke the Trumas Hadashin. So again, once we've now seen a lot of sugyas together, so this Trumas Hadashin comes up in a number of different contexts. And it's relevant to understand a few different things, but the Trumas Hadashin maintains that when he talks about the Chazak of Shem Ochsin Batalis, which is an important consideration we have to consider also, so he says that it's not really a actual chazaka. And it doesn't work for the full purposes of chazaka. But it's good enough to keep us out of Kol Dal Mivar. And essentially, Kol Dal Mivar seems to be something we want to avoid. So his default seems to be that if we don't have to do Kol Dal Mivar, we won't. And he says in that tshuva that it's kind of like Dina de Parsoi, which I assume was a reference to the Gemara that says that Dina de Parsoi, a Persian Dayanim, they do Dina below Dina, they invoke justice, it doesn't really have justice, doesn't really make sense. So he seems to see Kol Dal Mivar as kind of a lower level of judicial practice. So we'd rather not do it. So as long as we have some basis to say Yachloku, we'll take it. But it's not an actual chazaka for those intents and purposes we require a chazaka. So therefore he says in this context, but if you have a rove, so a rove would outweigh the achloku on our Mishnah. It's not a situation where it's a rove taking away from a chazaka, because this is not a genuine chazaka. So why do we use it at all? Why do we invoke it? We invoke it because it's a way of saving us from Kol Dal Mivar. So again, that's a useful statement in terms of giving us some perspective about what we prefer and what we don't prefer. If you recall, that Trumas Hadashin was invoked also recently because he also talks about Migo and the fact that it is enough to push away a Migo, according to a lot of Rishonim, but not a Rove, and that's a discussion that's relevant to the Migo point. Ali?
So we said that because we want to avoid Kol Dal Mivar, the Chazaka that we use, how does that relate to Rove?
So he says it's not really Rove can't be Motzah min HaMochzak. Right? But in a situation of Shnei Mochs and Batalis, if one side had a rove, we'd let that side win. So why should we let him win? Isn't he being motzim and a mochzak? Nah, it's not really a mochzak. That it's only a mochzak for this purpose. It's only enough to save us from kol d'alvim gevayah. But it's not actually a chazaka. That's his point.
But I thought that that when there's a majority of tefisa, that we just split up the ratio differently. The yachluk works differently. Like 3/4, 1/4.
So you're saying that's rove, you mean? That's proportional. It's different than rove. They say the rove as a point that makes you win because you have a rove on your side. And if the majority is like me, that's not the same thing as breaking it down proportionally. That's saying that because I have a rove, I win. So should a rove outweigh a chazaka? So normally not. He talks about other nuances. They're awesome. Maybe sometimes it does. But for the most part, a rove doesn't outweigh a chazaka. So he says, in this circumstance, a rove will win. Like the Ramban also says in his commentary to Baba Basra, and Bari Vashema, Bari will win. And this chazaka is not so strong that it's going to fight off other factors. So then why do we care about it? So we care about it enough because it is able to define it as something that doesn't make us have recourse to kol d'alvim gevayah. Kol d'alvim gevayah is bad, basically, says the Trumas Hadesh. Yes, sir.
Okay, we mentioned
for
the Rashi, the Rashi says that if it's like Lamekam, then Yachlokum.
Right.
Didn't we say last time around that means that he dislikes Yachlokum?
That
it means that he thinks Yachloku is a less desirable because it says that if we can't do anything, so then Yachloku, meaning
within the Rashba, we said that if there's a reason, the Rashba is not necessarily dealing with it in the same way. Leka lomekim lo demilsa could be both a positive and a negative.
Yeah, but we said last time that it seems to be a clothing very special.
Last time you're talking about in which context? According to who?
The Rashba.
The Rashba.
If it's likely that the case can be clarified further,
right,
then we see Yachloka.
Correct. I don't know if that necessarily means that it's preferable. In this case, it might mean that. It might mean that he's saying that if we could figure it out, we'd rather figure it out. So then maybe a kol d'alvim gevayah is preferable. You could say it another way, that sometimes kol d'alvim gevayah is a positive. It means that we're not going to be embarrassed by something else contradicting it. So sometimes it might mean that we'd rather do what we're doing, as long as we know that it's not going to contradict anything else. So depending on who's using it, lech l'mekam l'milsa could be both a positive or a negative. It could mean that we're stuck because we have no potential of figuring it out, or it could mean that we're able to do something because we know we won't be contradicted. So it could be invoked in both contexts. So in terms of the Rashba here, what does it mean in terms of his preference? And maybe it means he prefers kol d'alvim gevayah. Okay, so how does that sound so far? Everybody basically doing okay? Any issues? Any questions? Should I repeat anything so far? Okay, so then we started talking about the different details of each one, about Yachloku, and about Kol D'alvim Gevayah, and about Yehi Munach, and about Shuda. So we'll just try to talk a little bit about Yachloku. So one of the major questions was, is it a pshara or is it an actual din? Or is it both? It's very possible that there are two separate systems. And sometimes we say Yachloku as a din, and sometimes we say Yachloku as a pshara. For example, it was suggested that that's got to be what the Rivam is saying. That if he says that there are two different types, that you don't need Ochsin, you just need no Ramai. But if you have Ochsin, then you can split it even with a Ramai. So that definitely gives some support to the idea that there are two different types of Yachloku. There's one Yachloku that is more Maker Hadin, and there's one that is up Shara. Hi.
The Tosfos
on
some base where he said that by the Aniya Gertia case, where mm-hmm. we would say Yachloku in that case, because the
right.
Shu would make him be Porish. Is that the Riva? Because
it's a different Tosfos, no?
Right, but because the Tosfos mentioned that as a Palupa Shiapuli of MS.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't that contradict that if you have a Vada Rama?
Is if Tosos says you have to have, yeah, I mean, it's against the Rivam.
No, it's against the Tosos,
Why is it against Shavuot Tam?
He says it has to be a full Kashuk for Semis. It's not possible. I mean, that they both sewed it together.
Right, so, saying, so then it's not. So then you get into a question. And see, that Rashi says you can't have it both. It's Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos. Right, Rashi says.
It could be that they
did
it together.
No, so the basically the point is that Rashi says that if it's an ER, if they both claim on ERRTIA, you can't say a Choku. Because there we know that's not the case. They might think they both own it, they both picked it up at the same time, but they know they both didn't sew it together. So therefore, says Rashi, you can't say Achloku, and Tosfos says you can't say Achloku there. So it seems to be that Tosfos is allowing for a situation where it's any Cholios Emes, except that as some Achronim explain, that maybe all Tosfos means is the question of what do we care about when we say Cholios Emes? Do we care just that it should somehow correspond to what may theoretically be a possibility? And we have in halacha sometimes a term, a tliya, something you can hang something on. But as long as something exists as a theoretical possibility, we can be told that maybe this random remote possibility is true. So is that all we care about? Or do we care that maybe it really should actually have a chance of reflecting what happens?
So, the first option means that it could have done it together?
Possibly. So not that they could have done it together, but that Tosfos, maybe Tosfos's disagreement with Rashi is that it's still Yecholios Emes, just not based on what they say. Now, they're lying, but it's still possible that they...
100% couldn't have been one of them so half, one of them so the other half?
Presumably not, and they would know that. You know, they wouldn't come and maintain that each one sewed the whole thing. So it's just a much greater stretch to believe that that's actually the case, that they each sewed half of it. Of course, anything's possible, but that's essentially so remote that we wouldn't even take that into consideration. But what comes out from Tosfos is that even though it can't be they're both right, but it still might be Chaluk Yecholios Emes. It still might be that they actually do both own half, just not based on what they're saying. So that could be the Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos. What do we care about when we say Chaluk Yecholios Emes? That maybe they're telling the truth? Or no, they're not telling the truth, but it still might be a correct din to give each one half. So that also then gets to the question of what do we mean by Yachloku? Is Yachloku a reflection that this could actually be the din? Or is it a way of saying that we're going to make a pshara? And, many suggest that the Rambam sees it as a pshara because the Rambam doesn't require any actual achiza. Perhaps. The question comes up also of why, for example, in Elul Metzias, why we don't say Yachloku if we have two parties saying that they both have Simanim for something, Simanim to Simanim. And the discussion was that some suggest that maybe there's a higher threshold that's put on a Motzi Aveda, that maybe a Motzi Aveda has to actually protect what he found, and he's in a different kind of role as a Dayan. A Dayan has the right to say, okay, I'll make a pshara between the two parties. But a Motzi Aveda doesn't have the right to say, I'll make a pshara between the two people who are coming forward. He has an obligation to actually return the property to the one who actually lost it. So there are some who suggest that that's the controlling factor, that there's a difference between the two in terms of how that plays out. So among the question of whether it's a pshara or whether it's an actual din, or whether it depends on which one, it could be both, is what's the significance of Ochsin? Even if you require Ochsin, what do you mean by that? Do you mean to say that it's an actual chazaka? That because they're holding it, so now it's really the premise that Mashatachas Yado Shalada Marei Shalo? Or do we say, no, that doesn't really necessarily follow and it's unlikely to be true? But it establishes them both as players, so therefore we're going to split between the two of them. So is this a genuine chazaka, or is it somewhere in between? Does it make each one a toface? And maybe a toface also creates a certain default. So that was a topic of a lot of discussion. What exactly is this kind of chazaka? And as we mentioned a minute ago, so the Trinus Hadeshin asserts that it's not a real chazaka. That it's not something that really would make either one a muchzak. It's just enough to create two players here, that it should be divided as such. And within that, so that also affects the question of Migo, as we saw. Now that we've discussed Migo, we can introduce that in this context as well. That the Rishonim who ask, when one party says it's half mine, the other party says it's all mine, and the person who says it's half mine ends up getting a quarter of the talus. So why shouldn't we say, let's give him the half the talus? Because he could have said, the whole talus is mine. So as we discussed at length recently, a lot of Rishonim say, no, it's Migo Lahotzi. So is that really accurate? Is it Migo Lahotzi? Is a person using Migo to take away from Muchzak? Or do we say, no, there's no Muchzak here, each one is holding it. That gives them a seat at the table, but it doesn't make them literal Muchzakim. Or should we say, a different possibility, they're both Muchzakim in the whole talus. They both have a claim to the whole thing, and therefore it's a different usage, the word motzim and a muchzak. You're not trying to take away from a muchzak, you're trying to exclude the other person from the muchzakos. The muchzak is shared right now, and you're trying to be motzi somebody else from that story. So maybe that's what we're looking at. So are we saying neither is muchzak in anything? Are we saying each is muchzak in half? Or are we saying each is muchzak in the whole thing? And then they split it as a reflection of that. So we discussed different ways to look at that. And then the question of whether or not we'll see it as a pshara will emerge also from those questions. Hi.
Let's say we say that each of it's the muhsak and whole thing. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it seems that some rishonim still say that's considered being a lechotzi. Why would that be? I mean, if each of the muhsak and the whole thing, can't you just look at it that each of them is being hachzik what they have?
Yeah, so then that would be fine. But in the case of the Migo situation, where now he wants to knock out the other guy from the guy claiming to have the whole thing, and you want to get an extra quarter that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise, so you're essentially knocking that guy out of the muksuk that he has on that part of it.
You're also being machzik what you have.
Right, except that you're not claiming that part. He only claims a quarter, and the question was, why don't we say that because of amigo, he should get the other half, so that would be amigo to knock the other person out of his muksukos. That was the potential issue. Okay, so there were a lot of nuances about that whole question, but those are some of the major points in terms of yachloku specifically that we zeroed in on. There probably are a few other points. Maybe we'll come back and fill in a few more, but those are some of the major issues. Should we see it as a pshara or an absolute din? Is it very possible that there are two types? And that certainly the Riva seems to be laying the groundwork for that, to say there's two types. And is it essentially a ideal approach or a b'dieved approach? All of that emerges from some of these discussions. So then we moved on. We talked also about when you say Yehei Munach and when you don't say Yehei Munach. And that Tosfos says that Tosfos on Daf Beis that you have a situation where you have a third party who's watching on behalf of two people. The situation of Mana Shlishi. So how do you decide what goes on there? So you have one person says, I gave you $200. The other person says, I gave you $100. And the Gemara wants to compare it to this. So why should you compare it to this if we require Ochsin, says Tosus. So Tosus suggests that Chashiv hahu shanifka tofis b'cheske shnehem ki'ilu hem atzma muchzakim bo. That since he's holding it on behalf of the two of them, so that therefore it's considered to be a chazaka for both of them. So therefore, because the problem is that's why we're constrained from doing it. That it should have been a yachloku, but we're bound by the problem of ein yicholios emes, and therefore we say yehei munach. And the Rush we saw had a slightly different formulation. The Rush emphasized that the person who's watching it knows that it wasn't belonging to both of them because at one point he knew who had it and who didn't have it. So that was a whole discussion the Stipler and others had, that is there a difference between Tosus's formulation and the Rush's formulation. Tosus talking more theoretically that it's simply not likely that it belongs to both of them, because it would have had to have been transferred while it was in the property of a third party, and that tends not to happen. Or is the emphasis that the person watching it knows that it's not true, and therefore he can't make up Shara based on that when he knows that it's essentially not the case. He knows that it's not what happens. So again, that also works off the premise that Yachloku is a type of Pshara, and Bezdin may be empowered to do Pshara, but other parties, such as a Shomer Aveda, as we said before, or somebody who took on a responsibility of Shmira on behalf of others, may not similarly be equipped to make Psharas, may not be in a position to do that. Okay, any questions about any of that so far? Everybody's good?
Hi. Stipler,
Stipler emphasizes the fact that, well, Stipler, the question is, there a difference between the Rush and Tosus? Tosus says, Ein chaluku yichol leos emes. Why not? Because, as Tosus says, so in order for it to be emes, you'd have to mean that one party was makna to the other party half of the disputed third. And that tends not to happen. While the Rush emphasizes that the person who accepted the responsibility, he knew when he took it that it wasn't even. So maybe that's the question. Is it that we're worried about the theoretical Yecholios MS? Or is it more that since the person who's involved actually knows that it's not MS in this case, so therefore, even as a Pshara, it's not a fair Pshara, and he's not in a position to impose it. He's not in a position to decide we're going to do a pshara. While a bezdin might be in such a position, but somebody who accepted the responsibility to watch the property, so that's going to be a violation of his responsibility, and he's not going to be allowed to, not going to be allowed to do. Okay, so yes, sir.
Did we also see Mr. Gstetter there?
Yeah, that was. And then he had, what did he focus on? Remind me?
Sorry.
I have to take a look at it again. He also focused on Tosfos and the Rush. Maybe something along those lines also. Sorry? Okay. So I think that those are the major key points in terms of just mapping out what Yachloku is and how it fits in with some of these other possibilities. So then we'll have to probably carry this over tomorrow. So we have to, what do we still have to do? We have to talk about Kol Dal Mivar, where we have some significant discussions to be had. We have to talk about Shud D'Daini, which is a shorter topic, but some significant points. Yehei Munach, which we said a little bit about. And then we get into Dror D'Mamona. That was a major topic, so that it's also on our agenda. And then all of the Migo components. So I think maybe we'll be able to cover that in a 3-day schedule if we go briskly enough. But we'll just, no pun intended, but or pun intended, depending on how you want to look at it. Two different denim of what briskly is. So essentially, we have to start off talking about Kol Dal Mivar. So we'll continue it tomorrow, but just one of the major questions in Kol Dal Mivar is, what does it mean? Does it mean that Beis Din essentially wipes their hands of the case? They say, we can't address the situation. It's not something that makes sense for us. And then the Gemara says, maybe it also makes a difference that if they were to face the property in question, if Beis Din seizes the property, so then they have a greater responsibility as opposed to a circumstance where they don't seize it. And that itself becomes a factor in the discussion. So the Gemara says, you know, "Delo tafsinan vi tafsinan lo mafkinan." Beis Din should not be tofeset to put themselves in that position. But if they do, then they can't let it release from their hands without clarifying how it should go. So is Kol Dal Mivar a washing of their hands? Beis Din basically saying, "We're just not going to deal with it. So whatever happens, happens. But it's not on our watch." Or is it some type of a birur? And we saw there was a fascinating point that the Rush maintained, such a tremendous chiddush, that it is some kind of a birur, because he works off the assumption that the party who is right will fight much harder than the party who's not right. Which is a fascinating idea. And together with that, he says that he's also afraid that the other party, since he is telling the truth, the other party, that maybe he'll bring Aiden. So therefore, he's also only willing to go so far in terms of this process, that if we're really going to pull out all the stops, so then maybe the other party is going to indeed have access to Aiden, and that's going to be quite embarrassing for the guy who's lying. So essentially, that's what the Rush maintains, that Kol Da'olam Kvar is a way of getting to the MS because of the passion for truth that will be present in the guy who actually is correct. And we discussed psychologically, there are a few ways to understand that. One is a loss aversion theory, that people are much more averse to losing something they have than they are committed to getting something they don't have. It's an interesting thing. People will pay a certain amount for something, but you have to pay them more in order to buy it from them, because they're more committed to not losing what they already have than they are interested in getting something they don't have yet. So it could be that that's a part of what's going on here. What the Rosh is saying, that the one who it really belongs to, so he's going to fight harder. He doesn't want to lose what's really his. While the guy who's just trying to steal something, who's trying to profit from something that's not actually his, so he's not going to have that same zest. He's not going to fight as hard. And it could also be related to a question of degrees of dishonesty. We mentioned there's been some work in that field recently also, that maybe people are capable of being dishonest to a certain degree, but eventually it runs out, that the average person is limited in how dishonest they can be. So therefore, if it's really going to be a knockout fight, so the one who's perhaps willing to be a little bit dishonest to make a claim that's not true, but he's not going to be able to push it as far as the guy who's telling the truth, and therefore the Rush is going to maintain that there is this path to truth that comes through Kol Da'olam Kvar. And a nafkamina would be, as we'll discuss, that therefore maybe Kol Da'olam Kvar shouldn't apply in a situation where the person doesn't actually know that he's right. That maybe it only applies if the person knows that he's correct and therefore he's going to fight passionately. But if he doesn't have the way to know, so then it's not necessarily going to be a valid approach. And that's also why maybe the Gemara mentions Ikla Mekum La Demilsa as a factor that should be involved in Kol Da'olam Kvar, because if it's about getting to the truth, so then we're specifically going to apply it in these circumstances where it's likely that it's going to lead to something that's going to actually be accurate. Okay, is there any questions about anything that we've seen so far today? All right, so we covered a lot, so maybe we'll stop there. And again, so our agenda now is to talk about more about Kol Da'olam Kvar and briefly about the other methodologies. We'll try to do that tomorrow. And George Mamona and Migo.